Enjoy food the way nature intended. Alaska Seafood, wild, natural, and sustainable. For more information, visit wildalaskaseafood.com.
I'm HRN's Executive Director, Katie Mosman-Wadler, jumping in to tell you about this week's episode of Meat and Three, Heritage Radio Network's weekly food roundup. This week, we're introducing you to some amazing women taking a stand.
So often, being sexually harassed feels like a loss of control. And so I wanted to have these very tangible guides to say, here's what you can do.
Others are pushing for more diversity at major food industry events.
I still feel really determined to do, you know, whatever I can to help shift that and in a direction that's not just more diverse, but more equitable.
We also have a report on that summer business staple, the lemonade stand.
The lemonade stand might be the purest form of starting a business. Low overhead, easy to get into, and requires little experience or special equipment.
Don't miss Meat and Three, your weekly 15-minute food news roundup from HRN. Subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or your favorite podcast app. Search MEAT plus sign THREE. And thanks, as always, for listening.
Welcome to Eating Matters, where we talk about food policy and how it impacts all of us. I'm your host, Jenna Liut, and we're broadcasting live from Roberta's on Heritage Radio Network. As a fellow Michigander, which I want to just tell you that's the official term for anyone from the state, water issues are of particular interest to me. The Great Lakes State, it is called, has a higher percentage of surface water than any other American state. And over the last few years, there's been a lot of activity with regard to the availability of clean drinking water in several of Michigan's major cities, while at the same time, a multinational corporation is benefiting even more from pumping this public resource for private use. Joining me to discuss these issues and his suggested remedy to the situation is Nick Schreck, environmental law professor and the director of the Environmental Clinic at Wayne State Law School in Detroit. Nick, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Okay, so let's just, to get started, can you just give us a few stats on, like, how much water exactly is there in Michigan?
Well, yeah, I mean, as you mentioned, Michigan sits right in the heart of the Great Lakes, which is about 20% of the available surface freshwater in the world. 80-some percent of the freshwater in North America is right here in the Great Lakes region. And so Michigan, as well as being, you know, bordering four of the five Great Lakes, also has an abundant supply of groundwater, you know, water that could actually be pumped out of the ground.
Okay, I actually have to admit that I did not know all of those stats, even though I hail from that state, but that's very impressive. Okay, so then can you give us a sense of, like, what of the percentage of water that's available? What is it used for? Where does it go? Like, what's the water life cycle, basically?
Sure. So the biggest water users in the state of Michigan it's actually agriculture is the number one water user. So either, you know, taking water from a river or a lake and using it, diverting it through a ditch or pumping it through a pipe for agriculture, or pumping groundwater. That's the biggest user of water in the state.
Mm-hmm.
Then after that, it's mainly electrical power generation. So coal plants that generate electricity, they draw in a lot of water, or nuclear plants that generate steam and to generate electricity, they use a lot of water. And then it goes on down from there, industry, and then eventually we get to municipal water supply, so mm-hmm. like the city of Detroit's water system, or smaller communities, their water distribution system, and then, you know, manufacturing, that type of thing. But the biggest user by far is agriculture.
I think that makes sense. And does that kind of track with what happens throughout the rest of the country, certainly the world?
Correct. It does. And, you know, one thing that is unique about Michigan, as I said, you know, we're a very water-rich state. And because we border all of these eight Great Lakes, there's this thinking, I think, within a lot of people in Michigan that water is something we don't have to be as cognizant about or as concerned about conserving and mm-hmm. protecting that resource. even though, you know, the Great Lakes are culturally very much part of us, we don't always think about how turning on the tap or how if we're washing a car in the driveway, how we might be wasting that water. Because again, we're just used to this abundance of this freshwater resource.
And the mentality. Like I remember growing up, I was at a friend's house and, you know, her mom was like running the tap and just like let it run. And I said something and she was like, oh, it doesn't matter. There's so much water here. And I was just, you know, my initial, every fiber of my being was like, why? This is not okay. It's gonna run out. I mean, I don't know if that's true, but it was a sense I got.
And it's wasteful. And I think it's something that, you know, as the Great Lakes region and the Midwest, as our cities and states continue to be stagnant in terms of population, we haven't seen a lot of growth.
Yeah.
People are moving to the Sun Belt. You know, they're moving to the South. They're moving to the West, where there isn't that abundant supply of water. And so I think we have to be aware of the fact that other thirsty states are looking at us in Michigan, looking at the Great Lakes, looking at all of this fresh water supply, and they're wondering, you know, how can they get some of that water? And that's where I think we need to be better stewards. We need to be more responsible, and we need to look at, you know, how we're actually effectively giving away water for free in this state and how that could, you know, over time lead to some pretty bad consequences.
Right. And we're going to talk about that with regard to the multinational corporations that I mentioned in the intro. But I mean, just before we do that, do we actually pump any water out of the state right now?
So
like for other lake states,
a compact that's in place with between the 8 Great Lakes states and 2 Canadian provinces. There's a compact between the 8 states that's called the Great Lakes Compact, and that prohibits any large-scale diversion of water. So a big pipe or, you know, massive tanker trucks or ships of water, they cannot be diverted out of the Great Lakes. And there's some very limited exceptions to that compact. And one of the exceptions is actually water in containers smaller than 5.6 gallons. So that's the so-called bottled water loophole. So there isn't, you know, a massive pipe that's diverting water out of the Great Lakes. There is the Chicago River in Illinois actually was reversed by engineers to flow downstream, and that actually diverts some water out of Lake Michigan. But that was existing before this Great Lakes Compact was passed. So the intent was to keep the water in the Great Lakes because most of the water here is actually left over from the last ice age. It was part of glaciers melting, and only about 1% of that water is renewed every year through rain and snowmelt. So if you start withdrawing, using, consuming a lot of water, you could over time see a depletion of the Great Lakes.
Is that, I mean, I'm assuming that those figures are much greater in other states with less precipitation. So is 1% like actually a lot compared to other states, or is that just?
It's a lot of water. Yeah. I mean, we do get, relative to other parts of the country, you know, Michigan is a relatively wet state in terms of precipitation.
Yeah.
But just to think about, you know, It's something like 4 quadrillion gallons, which I can't even really get my head around what
that
means.
I don't really know what that means.
But a massive amount of water in the Great Lakes. And so just to think about how only 1% of that is actually renewed or brought back into the Great Lakes system each year by rain or snow.
Terrifying.
And so over time, you could deplete that through overuse.
Yeah, absolutely. I feel like we're probably working really hard to do that. So, okay. So what is, like, corporate involvement with regard to water in the state? We talked about, like, the company I'm referencing is Nestle, and they just actually had a big announcement recently. So can you tell us a little bit about, like, the company's involvement in the state and what operationally what they're doing there?
Sure. So water in Michigan, and in fact most the eastern United States, so east of the Mississippi, most states follow this common law. It's really a property rights issue when you deal with water. And what I mean by that is that if you own property, you typically have the right to use water under your property or adjacent to your property, so long as you're not harming other users. And we call this the reasonable use doctrine. And so Nestle actually owns property in Michigan. They bought some parcels in the northern part of our lower peninsula. So, you know, the Michigan people put their hand up and show you where they're from on their hand as a map. It's the northern part of our lower peninsula. Nestle owns property, and they can therefore then pump groundwater or capture spring water and then take that water, bottle it, and sell it. They're not the only company doing this. We have Coca-Cola that bottles their Dasani product. And we have Pepsi that does their Aquafina product. We have a company called Absopure that bottles a lot of water in the state. Nestle has received a lot of attention because they sought to pump water back in the early 2000s, and they were actually sued by a conservation group called the Michigan Citizens for Water Conservation. And a judge actually put a cap on the amount of water that they could pump, arguing that it would impact surface waters. So that they're pumping groundwater, but that could harm wetlands or that could harm streams, lakes, that type of thing. And so now Nestle has come back, a dozen or so years later, and they've looked to increase their pumping at a number of these wells where they actually, again, they own the property. So they have a right to use that water. But the question is their use of their water actually, harming neighboring property owners or harming our shared natural resources, which I argue includes all of our water in the state, that it, really shouldn't be something that's monetized like this for a corporation to make money.
Do other corporations, have they had similar issues, or is this something just specific to Nestle in the particular area that they, in the area they own land?
So Nestle's received a huge amount of attention, I think in part because they're such a big name. Everyone's heard of Nestle. And I should note that the product that they sell from the water they're bottling in Michigan is called Ice Mountain. That's the brand that they use, even though we don't really have mountains in Michigan. They call it Ice Mountain, and it's a spring water product. And then they also bottle something called Pure Life, which is another Nestle brand that is sold, I believe, all across the country. Mm-hmm. They've received a lot of attention, I think, in part because they're, a big multinational corporation that people have heard of. But what's also interesting is that I mentioned Coca-Cola and Pepsi and how they bottle water. What they actually do is they buy water from a municipal water system, and then they filter that water and bottle it. So if you're buying Aquafina or Dasani bottled water, you're actually just getting a filtered tap water is what you're paying for. And that's different than Nestle, where they're trying to actually get this water from the source, from a spring. And that can have more damaging natural resource impacts because you're pulling water from an area where that spring might be feeding a wetland, or it might be feeding a small creek that flows into a river, and you could have impacts to fish or to frogs and other aquatic life. Wow. So Nestle, like I said, there's other producers that are doing similar things, but this Nestle issue has really galvanized a lot of attention. And I think in large part it's because of the Flint water crisis and some of these other water issues that we've had in the news that have really drawn people's attention to how we're using our water resources in Michigan.
Yeah, let's talk about Flint. What happened there? Can you actually, honestly, can you give us just sort of a recap? I think we have a lot going on in the news cycle, right? And, right. A lot of times it's kind of out of sight, out of mind. Like, these are major crises and they're top of mind for one news cycle. And then there's the next big thing that happens. So for all of us who have, shorter memory, attention spans these days, sure. Can you just kind of give us a recap of what happened?
Well, and this is, I guess, my sort of elevator speech about the Flint water crisis. But, Flint, Michigan was a city that had boomed along with the growth of the automotive industry. This was Buick City, where General Motors, the Buick brand was founded. And then over the last 30, 40 years, as a lot of those jobs went away, the city of Flint also lost a lot of population. So now the city of Flint today and some surrounding areas, it's around 100,000 people that were actually served by their water supply system. And Flint went through a bankruptcy. Mm-hmm. Flint actually, there's a state law that allows our governor to appoint what's called an emergency manager. And that emergency manager then effectively runs everything with municipal government. They can sign contracts, cancel contracts, hire people, fire people without approval of city council in most cases. Hmm. And that emergency manager, as a cost savings measure, decided to get the city of Flint off of our Detroit municipal water supply. And I should note, for people not in this area, this is a massive geographic area. I mean, it's, probably 70, 80 miles from Detroit to Flint. Mm-hmm. And they were all part of the same drinking water distribution system.
And, where does that come from? Sorry to interrupt. Where is the Detroit water, municipal water supply?
Sure. So Detroit draws water from Lake Huron, one of our Great Lakes. And then also further down, closer to the city of Detroit itself, they also draw in water from the Detroit River. Big, large surface bodies of water where they pull in water, then they would treat it and pump it to homes in Flint and all over the rest of their service area. And so Flint had this idea, along with the county, Genesee County, where Flint is located, to get off of that Detroit system, because they were arguing that they were basically being charged an unfair rate for water. So it was a cost savings measure over the long term for them to develop their own drinking water intake and to process their own water. But what happened with the water crisis is that in the interim, before Flint gets this whole new pipeline to Lake Huron put in place and they've got all their new systems online, they were going to use this old drinking water treatment plant in Flint that was really there as just an emergency kind of backup in case something went wrong with the regular Detroit distribution system. Mm-hmm. So they, with too much fanfare, they flipped the switch. They started pumping water through this Flint system, and they're drawing the supply from a river called the Flint River. So they're pulling water from the Flint River. And what happened was they weren't treating it appropriately, and the water was more corrosive, and it started leaching metals like lead and copper out of the pipes. So if you have a lead pipe, and if the water isn't treated properly to prevent corrosion, mm-hmm. it can leach that lead out of the pipe. Then that lead gets into the tap water, lead gets into people's blood, and they get lead poisoned. And so effectively what happened is you had, you know, tens of thousands of people within the city of Flint that were poisoned because the water treatment system wasn't run appropriately. Water was distributed, leached lead out and copper out of pipes, and then that made, you know, that got into people's bodies through their ingestion of the water.
So was the issue
in a nutshell kind of what happened?
Yeah, no, that's a great overview. Was the issue that it wasn't treated properly, or that like the whole infrastructure wasn't set up to be able to provide this kind of resource? If the water was treated properly, this may be a silly question, but if the water was treated properly after, you know, would it not have mattered that the infrastructure was like wildly outdated?
Right. So I've heard engineers describe parts of the Flint system as like Swiss cheese. You know, you had so many leaks, of water leaking out of their distribution system. So that infrastructure was certainly a problem. The water treatment plant there in Flint that they switched over to had not had the type of upgrades that were required to provide water to 100,000 people. So infrastructure is definitely a problem. But had they actually treated the water with, it's a phosphate, a chemical, had they treated the water with this additive, mm-hmm. it would have continued to coat the pipes with a sort of like a film. If you think of like a clogged artery or a hardened artery with this plaque that goes around the artery, mm-hmm. That's effectively what you do with this water treatment. You put a little film around the pipes, which prevents the water from interacting with that pipe and drawing any of the lead or copper out. Flint was not adding that additional chemical, which I've seen estimates as low as, you know, would have been a couple $100 a day for cost for them to add that treatment, and that would have likely prevented the whole, you know, water crisis from happening.
Wow.
So really tragic, and a lot of mismanagement. You know, we should point out that there are several people have been charged with very serious crimes, related to the water crisis. So it's an ongoing tragedy, and the kind of judicial process is playing itself out as we speak.
Thank you for that. So what has come out of that? I'm imagining there have been all of these changes made because this was a huge issue. And by the way, I also want to say that there was a big announcement recently, wasn't there, in terms of the provision of clean water to people in the Flint area, which is, it was shut off, right? Which is like, it came kind of at the same time as the Nestle announcement.
The Nestle decision, right?
Yeah.
So you had the city of Flint, because the water system had now been effectively destroyed because the water wasn't treated properly. And then people were also, they had been lied to by our state government and told that their water was fine, and they kept drinking it and, you know, exposing themselves and their children to additional lead and other contaminants. So as a result of that, the state set up distribution centers where people could pick up bottled water for free.
Mm-hmm.
And they would go and, you know, load up their cars, or they would have, in some instances, water delivered to them if they were shut-ins or whatever. Well, the state announced the same week that Nestle received this permit to pump more groundwater for bottled water, the state announced that they were stopping the free bottled water distribution to the residents of Flint because, in the state's view, the water levels have now recovered to a safe, safe standard that people can go ahead and drink it and not have to worry about their health.
Mm-hmm.
So the optics of that were really bad. The fact that you had these two decisions announced the same week, and one footnote is that Now, again, a week or so after that decision, Nestle announced that they were going to be providing 100,000 bottles of water per week to the people of Flint for free for the foreseeable future.
So nice of them.
You know, these things are they're not the same issue, but they're very closely related because we're talking about water and we're talking about, you know, bottled water versus tap water and all of that.
There's also a very real environmental cost. I mean, obviously, if it's an emergency, it's an emergency, but there is a real environmental cost to providing, you know, bottled water in plastic water bottles to in that kind of volume.
And I mean, we're not even talking about, right, the petroleum that goes into those bottles, the gasoline that's expended to ship it from, you know, wherever it's bottled to where it's distributed. The lack of recycling, how abysmal our recycling rate is for plastic in the state of Michigan. So, yeah, I mean, all those things on top of it. And plus, you know, just think about how horrible it would be to go through your life every day and to have to cook with bottled water, to have to wash, to take a shower, bathe with bottled water. I mean, this is an enormous inconvenience for people, you know, very, very damaging just to their daily lives.
Yeah.
And they're, you know, they're never going to get that back. And that's just, I think, a part of this tragedy that often isn't thought about, just like how difficult it is to try and live your life when you're unscrewing little, you know, 20-ounce bottles of water, and that's what you're using for all of your cooking and your sanitation.
I can't imagine, and it's just, it's terrible. It's terrible. So what else, I mean, could they... What else could you do? And this is a total side note, but I'm just curious, like, how else could you treat the water? Could you treat the tap water on your own if you boil it? Or, I mean, that's an enormous inconvenience in and of itself also. But is there anything else you could do besides relying on bottled water?
Well, the problem with the Flint water crisis was that, you know, boiling actually doesn't help with the lead issue at all. In fact, it might actually make it worse.
Really?
So you wouldn't want to boil your water. I mean, the boiled water advisories usually happen when there's bacteria potentially in the water supply, so like an E. coli outbreak or something, where if you boil it, you can kill the bacteria. But for lead and copper and other heavy metals or minerals that are in the water, the boiling doesn't actually help. So sadly, and there were, initially when the crisis happened, they had problems with other issues too. Their chlorine levels were wrong in the water, so people were getting rashes. I mean, there was just this whole litany of problems that people had. But yeah, I mean, really the upshot is that you needed to bring in a water supply outside of the pipes in Flint. So it was basically bottled water was what they had to use. Eventually, they were able then to, you can install filters on your faucets, which can also pull out the lead. And so most homes also then had filters installed. And that's great, but then you have to change those filters every so often, or they lose their effectiveness. So anyway, it's a real, real just kind of ongoing tragedy that we're still seeing, you know, the repercussions from today.
Yep, and that I think people have kind of forgotten about if they don't deal with it every
right.
day. Okay, so we're going to take a really quick commercial break and hear a word from our sponsors. But when we get back, I want to talk a little bit about regulations, current regulations governing water safety and usage, and, you know, what some of the proposals are in Michigan post the Flint crisis. So stay tuned.
Think about what it takes to swim a coastline longer than the entire eastern seaboard and leap tall waterfalls in a single bound. What does it take to survive 200 feet deep in icy salt water? What would you be made of? Wild Alaska seafood is made of tight muscle mass, long chain omega-3s, and incredible micronutrients. It matters where your food comes from. Experience the flavor of the fittest in every bite and enjoy food the way nature intended. Alaska Seafood, wild, natural, and sustainable. Ask for Alaska on the menu, grocery store, or smart device. For more information, visit wildalaskaseafood.com.
The great distinction between your life and the stories told. About the deeds that made you.
And we're back. on Eating Matters, where today I'm speaking with Nick Schreck, environmental law professor at Wayne State University, a law school in Detroit. Okay, Nick, so before the break, I said we're going to talk about regulations, and now let's talk about regulations.
All right. What?
See how that works? Well, first, can you kind of give us a super brief history? This is a very broad question, but what has the regulation of water and water usage in the past kind of generally looked like? And is it predominantly, where does the more stringent regulations, is it at the federal level, state level? Does it vary wildly between states? I just threw a lot of questions at you, but let's start with kind of a brief overview of what the original intentions were of, regulating water.
Yeah, so a couple of things. When we talk about groundwater, that's historically been dealt with by what we call our common law. And that's, as I mentioned, in the eastern United States, we talk about this reasonable use doctrine, which means that if you own property, you have the right to use water. Either we call it riparian, which is a fancy word for you own land adjacent to a river, lake, or stream. Or the groundwater. But as far as regulations, the main federal law that deals with drinking water safety is something called the Safe Drinking Water Act. And the Safe Drinking Water Act, that sets levels of types of pollutants and things that you can have in the water and that needs to be screened out of the water to make it safe. So that's the main federal law. And then as part of the Safe Drinking Water Act, there's really an addition to it, which is called the Lead and Copper Rule, which was written by the Environmental Protection Agency. And that's what sets levels, we call them action levels for the amount of lead. But if that's present in the water, that triggers a whole series of management responses from the state and federal agencies when you meet that level. So for lead and the Lead and Copper Rule, it's 15 parts per billion. That when that level of lead is present in the water, it triggers additional testing, and they have to warn the public and all those types of things. Mm-hmm. So there's been kind of a mix between primarily the Safe Drinking Water Act, which states have passed very similar versions of the Safe Drinking Water Act in their own jurisdictions, that's kind of the main federal law that then has been adopted by most states. Then you also can have some additional state laws that could be passed, which would deal with water quality. So that's on the drinking water safety side of things. As far as the Nestle situation and their pumping for bottled water, those laws are really much more, I'd say, lax, and they've just been they're like newer types of regulations, because historically people that were pumping groundwater, there was really no permitting. You didn't even really have to register these groundwater withdrawals. It was just something that people did for agriculture, they did for their own personal use. But now we're starting to see more tracking of that, and Nestle did have to actually study potential impacts to neighboring wells and to natural resources due to their additional pumping.
What do you mean?
That's a lot, but
no, that's perfect. What do you mean by historically, though? What is the time frame that you're kind of referring to, past 15, 20 years, or past 75 years?
Yeah. So as far as the groundwater withdrawals in Nestle, this is really since 2008. That's when we had that Great Lakes Compact was passed that I talked about, and with that, the eight Great Lakes states that were preventing diversions of water, they also passed water management rules within their own jurisdictions, trying to protect groundwater as well as surface water. So, really we're talking the last 10 years that those regulations have changed for the pumping of groundwater.
That is actually shocking to me. That is very recent history. Wow.
Well, even today, there are, I'm certain, many large volume wells, pumping perhaps hundreds of thousands of gallons of water a day for agriculture that are, basically unregulated.
Wow. Okay, so thank you for that awesome overview. I'm imagining post Flint and all of these kind of issues that are happening in Michigan, that there are a series of wonderful laws and regulations that have been placed to prevent anything like Flint from ever happening ever again. And so can you tell us what some of those are?
Well, one of the shocking things about the response to the Flint water crisis here in Michigan is that our legislature has really failed to act in any meaningful way. They passed a couple of Band-Aid provisions, like I mentioned, providing bottled water to the people of Flint and providing filters for their faucets, lead filters for their faucets. But as far as meaningful regulatory change, we've seen basically nothing. So what we have right now, there's a rule that's been proposed by our governor, and they can do this administratively. The governor can direct our Department of Environmental Quality to pass regulations administratively. And so they've proposed revisions to Michigan's lead and copper rule under our Safe Drinking Water Act that I alluded to previously, which would lower that action level from 15 parts per billion down to 12 parts per billion. And Michigan would then have the most protective or strictest lead and copper rule regulations in the country. But I should point out that there's no safe level of lead in our water. I mean, this is just it's more of a screening and a management tool. You know, ideally, none of us are drinking any water with lead in it, right? Yeah. That's just not something that we want to have.
I don't really want to do
so
that.
So that's a good step. Yeah. The other thing that this regulation that would be passed by our Department of Environmental Quality would require is that we would replace all of these lead service lines. So these are the water lines that would go from a water main in the street into someone's home. There's estimates that there's about 400,000 of those pipes, those service lines in the state that would have to be replaced by 2040 would be the timeline. And that the issue there, though, is that there's no money in this regulation. It's just sort of like the old unfunded mandate. You know, the state telling local water utilities that they have to replace all these service lines, but without providing the money to actually do that work.
And so I want to talk in a minute. You have a really, a solution to that, from like a fundraising perspective that I want to talk about in a minute. But before I want to just kind of chat a little bit more about some of these regulations. So nothing really substantive has come out of, Flint, which is shocking and devastating. Snyder does, however, have a proposal kind of in the works. And part of that would be to replace the lead pipes. And I'm wondering if this was like in response to or already happening. I read the American Society of Civil Engineers report recently that basically grades states, they're like the status of their infrastructure, basically.
Yes.
And Michigan got a real bad grade on that one. So like a D plus, like I could not, if I ever got a D plus on anything, I would be so upset. So what does this mean? Right. And how do these, was this in response to that report or had this already been in the works? And would the proposal, Snyder's proposal, like make a meaningful change to the state's overall infrastructure quality with regard to water?
Yeah. So that report, I mean, that includes roads and bridges, utilities like electrical as well as water. But it does include water distribution, water treatment at sewage plants and that type of thing. So a big reason why Michigan has a failing grade on our infrastructure has to do with the lack of investment in our drinking water treatment plants and in our wastewater treatment plants, because, water is basically, it's a big recycling system. And, a drinking water plant might pull water out of, let's use the example of the Detroit River, pull water out of the Detroit River, and then people in Detroit use that water, we drink it, we go to the bathroom, that water is then collected and goes to a wastewater treatment plant, a sewage plant, where they treat that water and then discharge it downstream in the Detroit River. And then a community like Toledo, Ohio, pulls water out of that same river river system and uses it for their drinking water. So it's a big recycling system. And when you don't maintain and upkeep those systems, you can lead to, more pollution, which then is more expensive to treat and can lead to all sorts of problems.
Yeah.
So that D-plus infrastructure grade includes water infrastructure. But Michigan, we've had a real battle with just trying to maintain our roads and keep them in somewhat drivable conditions. I feel like this isn't a very good advertisement for tourism in the state. It's a wonderful place to visit.
It is an amazing.
Even though we've had these challenges with a stagnant population, we were hurt really bad even pre-recession through loss of manufacturing jobs. So it just hasn't been enough money to go around to maintain all of our infrastructure. And that's what that Society of Engineers report demonstrates, is that we're way behind the curve in funding our infrastructure here.
Right. And I'm sure that there are other, yes, absolutely. I would never want anyone to listen to this and be like, I'm never going to Michigan. It is a gorgeous state. It is, the people obviously are amazing. There's a lot of really great things happening. Worth noting, a lot of issues in every other state in the in the country. Yep. So I'm just focusing on you know, these particular issues of Michigan, and hopefully my goal is that people might want to get involved and actually help move the needle on some of these.
Right.
So that is that report. What other, let's talk about your kind of proposal, right? We need these upgrades. There's no money. You have a very interesting suggestion about how we can kind of raise money that would be, directed to making some improvements in the state with regard to water. So you want to,
back to Nestle as an example. This is a company that's pumping millions of gallons of water to then sell as bottled water. And the way that we typically pay for water is that water, there isn't really a price on the water itself. So if I pay my water bill for the Detroit water system to send water to my home, I'm really paying for the infrastructure. I'm paying for the pipes. I'm paying for the people to maintain that system. The water itself, there isn't really a dollar value placed on. And for Nestle, at these groundwater wells where they pump water for bottled water, they're charged a $200 fee. A $200 annual fee is all that they pay to the state for the right to take that water,
bottle it,
sell it, make money. And so, you know, my proposal is that Michigan should at least look at some sort of a tax or fee on all bottled water production in the state. So not just Nestle, but all the other companies that are bottling water as well. Or looking at some sort of a tax at the point of sale, meaning when someone goes and buys a bottle of Ice Mountain water from Nestle at the grocery store or the gas station or whatever, that they would pay a tax on that. And that's something that the city of Chicago has done. They have like a point of sale tax on bottled water. So, and the idea is that then you raise that revenue and you would invest that money, that revenue, in things like our drinking water infrastructure systems or wastewater systems, or, in things like habitat, wetland protection, which are also very important for water quality.
But this would be kind of I don't like the word penalizing, but it would be, you know, it would be kind of like consumers' responsibility to raise this money. So if we don't raise, you know, tax rates, for instance, they're still going to, the consumers, the citizens are still going to have to pay for this. Why not charge the corporations more? Like, is that just too obvious of a solution?
Well, I think one way to do it would be to have a sliding scale of a rate. So let's say, you know, per every 100,000 gallons of water that Nestle or another company were to pump, they would have to pay a certain percentage of a fee for that. I mean, that's another way to look at it. And that would be then a direct charge to the company.
Right.
And then I suppose if Nestle then had to raise their price of bottled water so high that then people weren't buying it, well, then they would perhaps reduce their pumping and, you know, stop. So you do, there's that kind of question of, is your goal to conserve water or is it to raise revenue?
Right.
And I mean, that's something where I think there's a bit of an art to these types of taxes or fees. You don't want to set it so high. If you're trying to generate revenue, you want to set it at such a price where people will still continue to buy the product.
Mm-hmm.
If you're looking solely to conserve water and to reduce pumping, then you probably would want a higher tax or fee that would potentially drive that business elsewhere, you know, out of Michigan to Minnesota or somewhere else, if that's your goal.
To California, where they have so much water right now and Nestle is still operating, right? Still.
Well, and that's just it. I mean, there's only... Again, surface water is a finite resource, and so, you know, you can only go to so many different places without having harmful environmental impacts or potentially, you know, the areas of drought. You mentioned California, but, you know, other parts of the arid Southwest where they just don't have any water to spare. And so they're starting to look at places like Michigan is where they might be able to, you know, buy water or transfer it elsewhere. So these are questions that are not going away. I mean, with a changing climate and a warming climate, we're going to see more and more stress put on our water resources. It's sort of a throwaway line now, but people talk about, you know, water being the oil of this century. You know, wars were fought over oil in the 1900s, and the, you know, wars conflict would likely result from water in the 20th century. So, you know, these are things to really be concerned about moving forward. So, you know, I think we're talking about Michigan, but I mean, this is really a national issue and a global issue, the way that we're managing our water resources.
Absolutely. Okay. So, and then does your proposal, that's in addition to Representative Lucido's bill that was proposed, right? Yeah. Can you tell us?
I mean, I guess really what I'm trying to do is drive this conversation. I mean, I think we need to have a really serious look at, you know, we're basically giving water away to companies to make a profit. And, you know, what about capturing some money to fund our infrastructure and to fund our natural resources? And so we have a state representative, Peter Lucido, who he proposed a 5-cent tax per gallon that the bottled water companies would have to pay. Mm-hmm. So anyone producing bottled water would have to pay 5 cents per gallon. He estimated that would raise about $20 million just from Nestle, just from that one company. So that's one approach. You know, I think there's other ways to do it. Like we talked about a sliding scale or something, mm-hmm. kind of like a graduated income tax would be a graduated water tax. You know, there's different ways to look at it.
Right.
But what I'm really trying to do is just get this conversation going and keep it going.
Absolutely.
Because again, I don't think this is an issue that's going away. It's probably going to get worse before it gets better.
And what has your sense been on, you know, people's interest in kind of getting involved in these issues? Do you feel like, I mean, it seems like people were really riled up about the Nestle decision, but does that actually translate into action, or is that just like a specific community that was really riled up? Like, you know, how do you feel people, like, is this on people's radars by and large?
I think it is. I think the public is ahead of our elected leaders on this one. I really feel like this is something that has galvanized public attention. Just to give an example, to put some numbers on it, this Nestle proposal to change the amount of water they could pump at one well, so just one of their wells, our Department of Environmental Quality received over 80,000 comments against this proposal.
Wow.
So people writing in or emailing, you know, over 80,000 comments against it. There were only 75 comments in favor of Nestle's proposal. But because the laws are so just sort of lax and easy to, it's relatively easy to get a groundwater permit. And so even though there are all these comments against it, you still had the permit was then granted to Nestle. But I guess the point is that 80,000 comments is an astronomically high number for this type of permit. Most of these things just fly under the radar. Nobody even comments on them.
Absolutely.
And I think because of all these issues we've been discussing, this is at the top of people's mind. So we're starting to see we've got a governor's race coming up in Michigan this fall, and these candidates that are campaigning for that, they're getting asked questions about Nestle, and they're getting asked questions about Flint. So I really think that, again, the public is ahead of where our elected officials are at this point, and that might be changing, because I think you're right. I mean, it's definitely really galvanized that public attention.
Well, that's good. That is really good news and good to hear, because, you know, I think that it's hard to get people's attention, you know, this day and age. So what else can people listening to this, even people in other states, you know, what else can we do to kind of get involved and to help drive the conversation and hopefully encourage elected officials to make the right choices?
Yeah, I mean, I think definitely for people in Michigan, it's something to contact your state representatives about, you know, your state House members, your state senators, our governor, definitely letting them know that this is an issue you're following and that you care about. People outside of Michigan, I would be, you know, vigilant in your own backyard. You know, for folks in New York, I mean, there's significant threats to New York's drinking water supply from the upstate New York. And, you know, what's the long-term sustainability plan there? Mm-hmm. And, you know, and if you care about the environment and you care about fresh water supply, you know, really consider avoiding bottled water as a product. You know, it's something that there's all sorts of environmental consequences above and beyond just the water itself. And so, you know, one of the best things I think we can do if we're concerned about these issues is to sort of use our dollars as the way that we vote, if you will.
Absolutely.
So, you know, not buying products that you think are having a harmful impact. And so, you know, again, I'm not against anybody making a buck, but I think there's ways to do this responsibly and then to also provide some revenue that, you know, if we can pass a tax plan or something like I've suggested in Michigan, where you can actually capture some of that revenue and invest it in infrastructure. Because I guess the final point I should make is that we have not had a legislature in Michigan that is even willing to really discuss these tax issues. That Representative Lucido's bill, that 5 cents per gallon bill, mm-hmm. Hasn't even been read in committee. It's just sitting there languishing, you know, on the books without ever being passed or even discussed. So, you know, we've got a ways to go, and I think public pressure is the way that this will actually get done.
Absolutely. Well, we're going to have to leave it there. And before I let you go, can you tell us how listeners can read, more about this issue? Can certainly look for, your opinion pieces coming down the pike. Where can they go to get more information, like from the Law Clinic and elsewhere?
Absolutely. So, I definitely say law.wayne.edu, mm-hmm. law.wayne.edu. That's our law school website. There's a link to our clinic there on the website. But another great thing, The Conversation, which that's the name of the actual journal that I wrote the article for, The Conversation, it's an online publication house. And on there, they've got a great list of stories about not only bottled water and my piece, but also stories about Flint and about water quality in general. And so that's a good place to go. Again, it's called The Conversation. And they have all sorts of really interesting. And these are all articles written by university professors, people that are experts in the field writing about these topics. So that's a good place to go for more information as well.
All right. That's awesome. Nick, thank you so much for joining us today. I really enjoyed our conversation.
I did too. Thank you.
All right. Great. Okay. I want to give a big thanks to our sponsors as well for their generous support. And also my fabulous engineer, Matt Patterson. Show music is by Tim Archer. All episodes of Eating Matters are available on the Heritage Radio Network website or as a podcast on iTunes and Stitcher. If you haven't done so already, please subscribe and leave me a comment. Let me know what you think. I'm Jenna Liute, and thank you for listening.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.